And welcome to On the Brighter Side. I'm your host, Monica Tanner, and I'm super excited about our guest today. He is an author, a speaker, and a very accomplished guy. And I'm so excited to introduce him to you and to learn more about him and all the things that he has learned through an incredible life event that he's going to tell us all about. Please help me welcome my guest today, Michael O'Brien. How are you doing, Michael?
Hey, Monica, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me with you. And I'm totally psyched to have a great conversation about things and the brighter side of things and all that jazz.
Awesome. Well, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your family?
Well, so I am a proud husband. Lynn and I have been married 25 years. So we celebrated our 25th wedding. Yeah. And we met in a personal ad before there was something called Match.com and So we met in Washington, D.C. I put out an ad in the city paper. It was a free ad. And I found the love of my life, my best friend. So we've been married 25 years. And we have two daughters, 18 and 21. So my 18-year-old's off to college. So we are sort of entering this phase of like pseudo empty nester, right? We know they're going to come back on break. So it's not true emptiness.
Gotcha.
But we are going, it's sort of like empty nesters on training wheels. So yeah, because my oldest will be a senior and my youngest will be a freshman. So that's my personal life. And I keep busy through like riding my bike as well as doing my speaking and executive coaching and writing a few books and all that good stuff like that, trying to help people with my message of what I learned way back when, which I call my last bad day. But, you know, the people in my Peloton, they're key. My wife and my two girls, I mean, I do everything for them.
I love it. I love it. So can you tell us the story of how your whole perspective on life drastically changed in what you call your last bad day?
Yeah. So it was back when the girls were really young. So 3.5 years old, that's the age Elle was. And Grady was only 7 months old. And we were in New Jersey, still in New Jersey. And I was out in New Mexico for one of those traditional company offsites where they would fly you out on Monday, they fly you home on Friday. And in between, they're going to torture you with PowerPoint. And I was like, well, I'm going to be really smart. I'm going to bring my bike out because I had this goal of riding my bike in every one of the 50 states, still working towards that goal. And on the morning of July 11th, I came around the bend. I carved out this really cool loop, Monica, in the hotel property, out the hotel back, up the main drag. And on the fourth lap, an SUV came around the bend and it was fully in my lane going about 40 miles an hour and it hit me head on. And I remember the sound of all the sounds and all the emotions of that morning, the sound of me hitting his grill into the windshield, the screech of his brakes, all that jazz. Like I still vividly remember that. And of course, you know, your listeners will say, well, clearly that knocked you out. And it did. And then I regained consciousness when the EMTs arrived. And then I asked the question that only another cyclist can truly appreciate. And I know you ride bikes from time to time, but I asked the EMTs like, hey, how's my bike? Because I was just trying to use anything to cut the tension in the environment. Cause I knew my life was in balance just by how the EMTs were behaving and just like how I felt. I was in the worst pain of my life. And I just remember willing myself not to fall asleep until the helicopter came. And I also told myself once I got onto the helicopter that if I lived, life would be different. I would stop chasing happiness. Yeah, I was doing a lot of that. I'll be happy when I get promoted. I'll be happy when I buy that new car or the house, and I'll be happy when the meeting's over, all that jazz. And I was really good at sort of chasing it and then catching it. And then it would just like poof, vanish. So I would go back to chasing. Mm-hmm. And I was doing also a lot of supermanning at work and at home because I was the leader at work. I thought I had to have all the answers. So I had to be Superman at work. I also thought I had to be Superman at home because I was the main breadwinner. I was the dad. And I had some of these like older perspectives, older world beliefs. And what I was doing was pouring a lot of stress inside. So here I was chasing, pouring a lot of stress inside. And in so many ways that SUV literally and figuratively knocked all that mojo out of me.
Wow. Incredible. So do you have any leftover like remnants of that or?
Yeah. So when I was coming out of my recovery, you know, it was pretty long and pretty painful and a lot of suffering. A lot of people would say, well, hey, are you back to normal? When I left the hospital, because I was in the hospital for like 3.5 months and I still had, even as I left the hospital, I still had like 10 surgeries in front of me. So people would come and this is really hard. Like sometimes we just don't know how to deal with people when they're in a moment of like crisis, right? We just don't know what to say. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of feelings about that that I write about in my first book. But a lot of people would ask, well, are you back to normal? And I'm like, well, my normal is like a new normal, right? There are things that I can no longer do. Like I ran a few marathons back in the day. I ran the Marine Corps. I ran the Boston Marathon. I can no longer run anymore. So if I got chased by a cougar or a lion, they're going to have a good meal, right? Because I can't run away. I can ride away, but I can't run anymore. And I still, you know, I still feel parts of the accident. Mm-hmm. What I chose to do though, not early on in the recovery, but as I came to sort of like my big shift where I decided that was going to be my last bad day, instead of focusing on all the things that I can't do anymore or don't have, I'm going to focus on the brighter side. I'm going to focus on all the things that I still have and I still can do. So yeah, so I still have some like pain and I still have some stiffness and I still have complications from it. But instead of focusing in on those, which can like really pull you down, I'm going to focus in on the stuff I still have. And, yes. You know, and the main parties are I still have my wife and I still have my daughters. And every night I go to bed and they're still in my life. Like, how could I ever say I had a bad day? Like, that's sort of the whole spirit of it. It's like that day was the day I decided to live life differently and have more gratitude and more resilience in my life. And certainly I have bad moments, but I don't want a bad moment to take any more energy than it deserves.
Oh, I love it. Way to champion my message of on the brighter side. No one does it better than you, just encapsulated it right there. But so how did the accident and this new perspective on life impact your marriage relationship?
Well, this is key. And I know you've done like a whole series of on marriage, which I just love. So when you take your vows, as before you become, husband and wife, we think, and same with values at work, like they're sort of under these conditions, like everything's going to be hunky dory for the rest of your life, right? It's unicorns and rainbows and butterflies and we love each other. And so when they say, in sickness and in health, right, it's like, oh yeah, we're going to be healthy. Like we don't really talk about in sickness. So we put values up or we have vows, I think, to really give us some guidelines, when something unfortunate happens. And so for me, like my wife is, the head of my peloton, like the head of my tribe, if you will, because it really did. It tested our relationship. When they first called her back then, we had Elle at 3.5 and Grady at 7 months old. Grady was still being breastfed. And so they called her up and said, hey, Lynn, you got to come out. You got to come out. Michael's been hurt. We think he broke both of his legs. And so as a cyclist, I've had plenty of, bike crashes and races and stuff like that. And she's like, hey, here, I'm busy. Like I got two kids under four. I'm breastfeeding one of them. I got things to do. Can you sort of patch them up and send them back? Right. Because the way they talked about the accident was sort of no big deal. It took 3 phone calls for them to convince her to come on out. And she still didn't really know the extent of what had happened, right? So mm-hmm. She brought me a couple cookies and she was like, well, Michael will love these cookies when he gets into recovery, a little snack. And then when she saw me and the fact that I got transported right to the ICU and the vascular surgeon came out and said, hey, your husband's been in a very bad accident. We did the best we could. The next 72 hours are going to be critical. She was like, oh, this is a game changer. And you really sort of understand like what your relationship's all about. And luckily, we invested in our relationship before that period, before that last bad day, because we had to leverage a lot of the, good deposits in that good deposit bank account. But it also required a lot of conversation because I was going through a lot. My whole identity had been shattered. And I really thought if I couldn't be who was I going to be? And that took a lot of like belly to belly, eyeball to eyeball conversations with her. And we didn't have any of the answers. There's no playbook for this. We had to sort of figure it out on our own. And, that's why like she is like the head of my peloton. She's like the reason why I'm here is because of her, no doubt about it. And when people read my first book, one of the best things, Monica, they can tell me, they're like, yeah, great story, but man, your wife is fantastic. Because what we included in the book were all the emails that she was sending out to our community. And they fall in love with her. And for me, like, that's everything. Like it's like the secret reason why I wrote the book for them to come away with that. And I was like, yeah, she's incredible. And she was a rock because she had to handle the kids the household, and now me, right? And there was a period of time where I was like, you know what? It may have been easier if I just died. And when I had sort of my pity parties because of the burden I was putting on her, like if I had passed away, then some of her burden, at least in my thinking back then, it wasn't necessarily all that rational, would be lifted. So she was incredible.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story. So I can tell you're going to use this word a lot. So I need you to define it and tell us what it means. But you keep saying Peloton. And I'm like, okay, tell us what that means to you.
Yeah. So sometimes when I mention it, people think of the Peloton cycles, right? The bikes on TV. And for me, a Peloton by purest definition is a group of cyclists in a bike race. So think the Tour de France, all those cyclists riding around and racing around France. Although they're on different teams, that community, that rolling community is a Peloton. Mm-hmm. And they need collaboration, they need communication, they need trust in order to go down the road as fast and as safe as possible. Even though they happen to be on different teams and they may have different agendas, they need each other. And for me, my Peloton is sort of like my tribe or my network. It's society. And so I came up with a name when I was in the hospital, and we had probably 15 medical staff around my hospital bed, and my wife was there. And after they left, I was like, well, they're sort of like my medical Peloton. Like they're, everyone had a different role, but we were focused on one common goal as far as bringing me back to health. And when my wife left, I was like, well, one day I knew I was going to get into this line of work. Just a lot of many years, a lot of watering, a lot of fertilizer. And I was like, that's the name of my company, Peloton. And I wrote it down. And then Peloton Cycles came out a few years ago, like probably 2015, 16, with a much bigger advertising budget and like models that seem to be more attractive than me. Which is totally fine. I'm totally good with that. They've brought the word into the public domain. But for me, it's about community, like who's in your Peloton. And everyone in the Peloton sort of has a different role, right? We're not necessarily doing the same roles, but we have a community that's built on trust and communication and collaboration and all that good stuff. And I use a lot of times as far as like a sort of metaphor for tribes at work.
Yeah. What a cool metaphor for marriage and family as well. I love that. I mean, that is just right smack on, dead on.
Yeah. Because, you know, like any good marriage, right? There are times where you're taking the lead and people are drafting behind you. Mm-hmm. You need, you know, communication. Certainly you need trust. Sometimes you switch roles and then the other person is taking the lead and, you know, and vice versa. And in the Peloton, as it's rolling, there's not much scorekeeping, right? So we're all sort of moving together, at least the way I define it. And I think a good marriage, what it has, obviously multiple things, but it doesn't keep score, right? And so last year, when it was the year of the dog, right, I talked about this a lot in my work in terms of relationships. So for any dog owner out there, one of the great things about dogs is that it's unconditional love, right? They don't keep score. They just keep on going all in. And I think a healthy relationship, a healthy marriage, also doesn't keep score. Mm-hmm. It doesn't like, well, last week I took care of the kids or I picked up the kids. It's, we sort of all go in together. We're all pitching in. We go all in.
Ideally.
Sometimes it's out of whack or out of balance, if you will. Mm-hmm. But hopefully over time, it sort of evens out where there's that equal share of like sweat equity that's put into it. But yeah, so I think, you know, a Peloton, at least the metaphor can be used in a lot of different ways in relationships, personal relationships at work, and even our society.
Yeah, I love it. Okay. So what do you teach about preventing bad moments from turning into bad days?
Yeah, so that's the new book I have out. And so when I first came out with this whole concept of a last bad day, a lot of people were like, really? Like, come on, right? You haven't had a bad day since. And I said, well, part of it is on the brighter side mentality. So what I share with folks is like, I've had many challenging moments. I've had bad moments, but I don't want them to have any more fuel than they deserve. I don't want a bad moment to turn into a bad day. And we know people where that's happened, like a bad commute or a bad meeting or a bad conversation. And then it sort of consumes us. And then it can ruin the day. Or if it happens at 3 p.m. on a Friday, it can ruin a whole weekend. So I broke out in my book some of the very things that I did coming off of my accident recovery to keep my last bad day my last bad day. So I offer up one, some rituals in the morning. So I'm a, you know, sort of a big morning ritual. Like, how do you start the day? How do you frame your day from not sleeping with your phone? But, you know, because a lot of times we sleep next to our phone and we check email and social media and all that jazz. But for me, the one of the best things one can do at the beginning of the day is just frame your day with your intentions in terms of what you want to be today. What do you want to see more of? How do you want to honor your values? And I think a lot of folks, because we are checking our phones right away, we get on this hamster wheel and we just get going, right? We're into the chase. And what I offer up in my last bad day shift is sort of the practice of setting your intentions for the day. I also offer up some things throughout the day, like at work, something called grabbing a PBR, which does not stand for Pabst Blue Ribbon, but rather pause, breathe, and reflect. Mm. Which is something that I learned, you know, I didn't know anything about mindfulness or meditation back in 2001 when I had my accident. But I knew, like, intuitively that connecting with my breath would be a good thing, like slowing everything down. So I took a page from my sports days, just, you know, and so I turned this into like pause, breathe, and reflect. So when things get going, when we're in a bad moment, because we're going to have bad moments, is to grab a PBR and just sort of slow it all down so we can be a little bit more thoughtful about what we say next or what do we do next. And one thing I offer up in the evenings is just a practice of gratitude. Right? Because we can get so wrapped up around all the crap that happened during the course of the day. And then we hit the pillow and all those thoughts pop into our head as we're trying to drift off to sleep. And we get consumed or we get filled with anxiety before we're supposed to, you know, go off and recover, you know, because sleep is all about recovery. So I love just spending a few minutes as we're getting ready for bed, brushing our teeth, if you will, and spending a few moments just thinking about what made the day special. And it can even be some of our challenging moments that hopefully will make us stronger. So a little bit of an intention in the morning, grabbing a few PBRs during the course of the day, and a little gratitude at night.
That's awesome. I love how you summarized that. Exactly. So in between all of that, for a lot of people, you know, you start your morning, they do some sort of work routine. Even if you're a stay-at-home mom, you're going to, whatever your routine is with the kids. And then in the evening time, which is supposed to be that just wonderful family, spouse together time, a lot of people are exhausted. So you use the phrase energy leftovers. How can we bring more than just our energy leftovers home for that really crucial evening time?
Yeah. So I think that happens in all circles. And we saw it as like a young parent couple, right? So like I would spend all my energy at work and I'd be exhausted when I came home. And Lynn would spend all of her energy doing the things in the household and with the kids. And then we both came together and we wanted to show up for each other. And we're just so exhausted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, dinner takes an hour to prep and 15 minutes to eat. And then it's bath time. And it's like, you know, your hair's on fire. So from what I offer up to folks is one, a little bit of a checklist or assessment of like five key areas that sort of do influence our energy a lot, you know, sort of our spiritual health or our physical health or relationships, even our financial health. But one of the things I often recommend to folks is spending time during the day just to sort of slow it down and just hit the pause button. Yeah, well, it's a little bit of PBR, but it's more about like intentional self-care throughout the day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So which is the PBR is more of this like micro doses of mindfulness, if you will. The self-care piece is like, how do we block off even 15 minutes, even a half an hour, just as they're like not do anything, but just like self-care, which is something, right? It's the whole act of recovering and being more mindful of when we're getting a little bit low on energy. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key things too is being more attentive as we walk through the door, whether we happen to be in a corporate setting or coming home and walking through that, our household door is like when, as we walk through thresholds, I think it's a good indicator, a good trigger, if you will. It's like, hey, how do I want to show up as I walk through that door? Mm. So we can be more intentional, right? And there are times where we're going to be tired. There's no doubt about it. Like it's not, again, the land of unicorns and rainbows, but if we can just pause just long enough to say, hey, I'm about to walk through that door and the people on the other side of it, they want the best of me, right? Mm-hmm. The best of me that I have in this moment. And if I can be a little bit more intentional, a little bit more aware about doing that, then I can sort of create the weather around me. So if I walk in all huffy, all down, they're going to pick up on that. But if I can just garner maybe 10% more mojo and show up maybe just a bit different, acknowledge them, say hi, do whatever, just energetically, I can set the course for the evening, maybe just a bit better, right? And so it's a practice of awareness, it's a practice of intention, but also throughout the day, just some self-care. When things get really sort of squirrely, the hamster wheel is really spinning, how do we slow it down a bit so we have enough energy for those at home?
Yeah. Oh, I love it. Even like some sort of either gratitude practice or even just like turning on the music and just like letting it all out on the way home or something, I think can probably be super helpful for just to regenerate kind of that energy.
Yeah, anything. Like we all have like a different, this is a really cool thing about the internet. There's a lot of advice out there. And what I love about it is that there's a solution for everyone, right? Mm-hmm. There's no one way. Right. So it could be like listening to music, not listening to music, listening to a book, like using that commute time, not as a way to get all worked up. Right. My oldest daughter and I were commuting back from New York a few weeks ago, and the traffic was horrible. It was like a double time commute. And I could tell like the drivers around us, as we were just stuck in traffic, their blood was starting to boil, right? You could see the smoke and the steam coming out of their cars, and they were getting worked up about something that they could not control. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how they're going to walk through that door. And they're probably going to walk through that door with a whole bunch of negative mojo, and which is going to like cascade into their family members. So what my daughter and I decided to do is, yeah, we made a game of the radio. We tried to guess the songs and the themes of the songs and all that jazz. And it was sort of a silly game, but it took our mind off the commute. And we showed up at our house more energetic than we would have if we just got consumed by like, why isn't traffic moving? Mm-hmm. And we're getting all worked up about that. So I think the solution can be different for anyone, but we have to have more awareness so we can find that action that makes sense for us.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So talk to us about rebounding after a setback, because obviously the accident, the last bad day was a huge setback for you. And then reaching your next level in both life and in marriage.
Yeah. So I think with setbacks of any type, so my accident was like the horrific type of setback. But sometimes we have setbacks, just we say the wrong things in a marriage. We might do the wrong thing at work, right? We might make an error. And I think those are some of the more common ones. Like hopefully my accident isn't commonplace. Like, one of the reasons why I go out and talk with people is I'm trying to help them avoid their version of their SUV, right? Mm-hmm. So stop chasing happiness, be aware and look at the brighter side of things and sort of release the stress, not bottle it up. So I think a big thing about it is trying not to personalize the setback. Like we're all going to have hiccups in our lives, blunders, if you will. And when I was coming out of my recovery, I knew this as I went through it, that I didn't have to be defined by the accident. The early phases of it, I started to find myself as a victim, and a whole bunch of people validated that, like, poor you. And I was like, poor me. And I took on this victim mentality, and I wasn't rebounding at all. There was no resilience in that moment. But then I realized, well, I can be defined by my response to my accident. Mm. And I think a lot of times when we have setbacks, and it goes back to this whole feeling, like life is about how we respond to it. So yeah, if we perhaps not say the right thing within a relationship, or we make a mistake at work, it's not all about that, but it's more important. It's more important to really focus in on how do we want to respond to that? How do we want to be known for our resilience? So not personalizing our setback, cataloging the learning of it as quickly as possible. So then we can have that in our back pocket. So the next time there's a hiccup, maybe we can prevent the next hiccup. But the next time there's a hiccup, maybe we can respond even faster. And when it comes to, like, I think a relationship or a marriage, you know this, Monica, like you spend enough time with someone for as long as you do, you're going to have disagreements. You're going to have different perspectives on things. You're going to have different moments of stress where you don't necessarily sync up, and it's not all lovey-dovey. And, I think the best thing is then to have that conversation, sort of talk it out and really listen to connect with each other. I think so often we get into these setbacks or disagreements, we start listening to reply to one another. Mm-hmm. We're waiting for the person to just stop talking so we can say the next thing, so we can win the argument. But if we take more of an attitude of abundance around our relationship, that, hey, I really want to connect and listen to you. I want to acknowledge and validate what I hear from you and be curious with each other. I think that's the best way to sort of get past some of the setbacks we have in any type of relationship. It's not easy. This is the emotional labor part of like any marriage. There's obviously a physical component of it, right? But it's an emotional labor type of partnership. And we need to be able to sit with each other and really listen to connect and understand each other, especially after we have some type of setback, whatever that might be.
Yeah. So learning those communication skills that you talked about are absolutely crucial, I think, to a marriage, and they are skills. So they can be practiced and they can be learned and perfected. So yeah, I love how you talk about that. As well as when you were talking, I just thought there are so many gifts that come with setbacks. Like you said, cataloging, you're learning from it. And I think that's so important because I feel like anytime we come across some sort of a setback, there are always gifts there. There's always lessons to be learned. And I think the quicker we can kind of pull those out and be like, okay, maybe the purpose of this setback was just to show me my own strength or to teach me this really important lesson that I'm going to need for this next phase of my life. There are so many gifts that can be extracted from those setbacks if we will just look for them, if we will stop playing the victim and we will say, what are the gifts here and why was this setback given to me?
Yeah, I love that, Monica. Because I think the most important conversation too that we have every day, multiple times a day, is the one that we have with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we play this loop about, I'm a victim, this is so unfair. And believe me, I was doing that pretty well. But if we can step outside of ourselves, maybe look at the other person's perspective. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it. It's just mainly acknowledging that they have a perspective. It's as valid as our perspective. And then we have a little bit of a back and forth in that type of conversation and really sort of think like, why is this showing up in my life right now? You know, a lot of people have told me over the years, your accident happened for a reason. Mm-hmm. And I do believe things happen for reasons. Now, not everything has a reason, perhaps. You know, I don't necessarily want to live in that sort of binary world where it's 100%, mm-hmm. but I think a whole bunch of things have a reason. And if we can just slow down long enough, if we can be curious just a little bit more, sometimes that reason becomes clear to us and it changes the conversation that not only we're having with ourselves, but the conversation that we need to have with the other person.
Yeah.
And that's when the magic happens. That's when we can move forward together as opposed to competing against each other.
So good. So good. So teach us about your CARE acronym. What does that stand for and what does that mean?
So, well, CARE really for me is about first connection, because when I look at how things get done today and how things have gotten done over the years is one, just having beautiful connection with each other. You know, it's speaking of like who's in your Peloton, like, are we there for each other? Because life is not a solo project. Marriage is not a solo project. We know that. Raising a family isn't. So how do we have more connection in our lives? In terms of awareness, I think that's key. That's like one of the top things I talk about a lot just from my recovery. I was living a life where I thought prior to my accident, I was following the script that I thought society wanted me to follow. Like I went to school, got a gig, met a girl, married the girl, started a family. And I didn't really live life with any type of awareness. I thought I was just doing what I was supposed to be doing. And what the accident showed me by giving me one major pause button was the whole value of awareness. Like what's around us? What are other people's perspectives? So that's key. The R is resilience. How do we build up more resilience? Because we are going to get knocked down in life. Things are not going to be so easy. We're going to have a setback or two or three. The key is how do we get back up, right? How do we get back up and pedaling again, if you will? So we want to connect with our greater purpose. We want to connect with the values that are important to us. Certainly not personalizing the setbacks, as I just mentioned, and cataloging the learning and then trying to apply those right away. And the more we practice resilience, the better we get at it. And then the E is really empathy. I think we need more of it. So, and by being a better listener, by being curious, by showing up with vulnerability and courage, we can connect better. I think we need it not only in our families, but we need it as a society. We're not being as empathetic as we could be. We can be very sympathetic, but the empathy of really sitting down next to each other and really connecting, really listening. And we may end up disagreeing, but we don't have to be so disagreeable like we are today, and really hearing someone's point of view. And maybe we can have a better conversation when that happens.
Your acronym goes full circle from connection to empathy and back. I love that. The way you describe that's awesome. So talk about breaking the cycle of negative self-talk that's holding back your success. How can we do this effectively?
Well, this gets to, Monica, the whole conversation that we're having with ourselves, right? So I see this happening, and hey, heck, it happened in my early part of my career. It's happened as an entrepreneur, happens as a dad, right? Like, you know, when our kids don't necessarily respond to what we have to say, you know,
think they know better.
Yeah, they get better, or they, you know, they sort of ignore our advice, or they might not think we're cool or what have you. Like we, you know, because we have this image that we want to be, right? I want to be this, you know, strong dad, you know, the teacher, right? But also I want to be the cool dad too, right? We want all of that, right? And like as parents and as a partner or as a spouse. And sometimes we read into actions of others and that sort of triggers these negative thoughts in our head. And I'm a big believer that our thoughts drive our emotions drive our behavior. Mm-hmm. And when we get sort of hung up on things that may have been from our past or different perspectives, it's all swirled up in our head and we don't know what to do. And sometimes we get into more of a flight type of mode where like, I'm the victim, woe is me. And I'm like, I can't believe this is happening to me. Life is so unfair. Or we get into more of a fight mode where we want to lash out and be argumentative. In either case, the ego is involved and we have this self-narrative that's holding us back from really truly connecting and having the type of joy that we could have in our lives. So part of it is paying attention to what our stories are. Like mm-hmm. what happens, our mind is so cluttered with so much stuff and we're scrolling through our phones and our emails that sometimes we don't know what's really happening up in our head. For people who start a meditation practice, what happens is early on, they're like, I don't know if I can do this. I got all these thoughts in my head. It's hard to actually focus in on my breath or a focal point. And what I share with people is like, well, that's part of the process, part of the wonkiness and choppiness at first, because all that stuff that's popping in your head is popping in your head when you're busy on your hamster wheel. So we don't necessarily know. So for me, changing the conversation that we have with ourselves and what I learned through my accident is moving from victim to, as cheesy as it sounds, victor. Mm-hmm. Right? Changing that dialogue and believing in the dialogue. And once we start to believe in our own dialogue that's more positive, then we can connect better with other people. And then we can have more happiness and joy and hopefully success down the road. But the first part of it is understanding, like, what do we say to ourselves when no one else is listening besides us? And being honest, this is the inner work that I think so many people, well, it would be helpful for a lot of people to do. Mm-hmm. But this is the hard work. We want sometimes Band-Aids to cover up the pain. But Band-Aids don't make the pain go away. They just cover up the problem. And not that I'm hating on Band-Aids. Believe me, as you know, a father of two daughters, we went through enough Band-Aids, yeah. Right? But for us to really do the work that we need to do, we need to dive deep. We need to look in the mirror and do that inner work. And part of that inner work is, what do we tell ourselves?
Yeah. No, I love that. Like how we talk to ourselves and the stories that we tell are so, they so poignantly affect our experience in life. And that's something that I feel so strongly about that I haven't really talked a lot about. Maybe I should do a solo episode on that. But the stories, the way we tell our story has so much of an impact on how we experience our life. If we're telling our stories as the victor and on the brighter side, it's so much more powerful than always being the victim and having this story where life has just been so hard on us and beat us down and all of that. And really, it is just a story. It's just the story we tell and how we tell it. And so I feel like, you know, if we commit to spending time and thinking about our stories and how we speak to ourselves, we can just drastically affect the way we experience our lives.
Oh, without a doubt. I call it MSUing, making stuff up. We can play with the S and with other creative words too. But but when you think about it, just that drives a whole bunch of our behavior. It would have been really easy for me to just stay a victim, right? I had enough people around me that told me.
Would have supported you in that. Yeah
totally. Like they would be like, what would you expect? Like this, look what happened to him, right? It would have been totally natural, totally reasonable. I knew this in my moment of like, aha, that if I wanted to become the husband I wanted to be and the father I wanted to be, then I had to change my mindset. I had to shift my story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I also had to shift my story to make my body better, right? Because the mind-body connection is so powerful. I thought in that moment, like, well, if you can worry yourself sick, why can't you think yourself well? But most importantly,
love that.
I wanted to show up better for my wife and my girls. Mm. And, you know, because I was grasping with like, what was going to be my identity. And I knew this, like, I could be like the best husband and father I could be. And I try to do that a little bit better tomorrow than I did today. Like, it's sort of this pedal stroke by pedal stroke ride to mastery. Like, I don't think I'm perfect by any means. But each day I try to wake up with the intentions of like, I'm going to be a little bit better today than I was yesterday.
Yeah.
And a little bit closer to being that version of being a husband and being a father that I want to be.
So the whole time we've been talking, I've kind of been thinking about this question and how I wanted to phrase it, because I actually think it's going to be so huge for some of my listeners to just kind of understand this and come to terms with this maybe, but tell me at what point, because I feel like you have definitely forgiven the driver of this SUV, but we haven't really touched on this. Like, what was that like for you? At what point did you forgive him and like release him of the pain that he inflicted on you? Tell me about how that came to be.
Yeah, well, that was 2012. So 11 years after the mark. So
wow.
So when I was in the hospital and I promised myself, hey, life is going to be different, Michael, if you live. Well, life was really dark, right? Because they told me about the accident. The driver had a revoked license and the accident should not have happened, right? He shouldn't have been driving, all that jazz. So I got really angry and I got bitter and I got revengeful, Monica. Like I would drum up ways to get back at him. So eye for an eye, right? That's sort of what I was learned, what I was taught when I was young. And over time, as my health was improving, I let go of a little bit of the energy towards him. Sort of like the concept of like, I had this backpack on filled with rocks mm-hmm. in the beginning, and I was taking out a pebble or two at a time. And then over the years, the backpack was getting lighter. But we took a family vacation to Europe, and we went to Normandy and Omaha Beach, and then we went to Krakow, and we had a private tour of Auschwitz, Birkenau, by a woman named Eva Kaur, who recently passed away. Her family was sent there in the during the war, and her whole family lost their lives in the Holocaust. But here's the thing about Eva. She was a twin sister, and twins were treated with a different type of hate during the Holocaust. And her twin sister survived the camp. So we were there and she was giving us a private tour of the concentration camp. And so it's the middle of July. It just reeks of death and the sun's beating down and we're just sweating. And she's driving around in her golf cart showing us around, like her experience. And someone at the end who got to Q&A, someone asked her like, well, how do you feel about the Nazis, the Germans? And she had done a forgiveness project a few years earlier, but I didn't know about it at the time. And she answered the gentleman, she says, well, I've forgiven them. And I was like, huh? Because I thought if anyone had any reason to have like her backpack filled with like hatred towards them, it would be her. You know, what they did to her family, what they did to her and her twin sister. And what she went on to say is like, listen, I've forgiven them, not because they deserve forgiveness, but because I do. She said, like, if I walked around with all that anger, and she didn't use this metaphor, but a backpack full of rocks, then I couldn't live the life I want to live. And we walked out of Auschwitz. We went back to the train. And as we're walking, I was like, if she can forgive, why can't I? Mm-hmm. And on that train ride back to Krakow, I totally released the driver. I was like, total forgiveness. And it was a powerful moment for me on that train ride back. I felt a lot lighter when we got back to Krakow, but I gave up a little forgiveness along the way, but you know, I was probably even lying to myself how much up to that point. But that experience with Eva was life-changing. It was remarkable.
That's so neat. What a gift. Well, that story says it all. It speaks volumes, really. So if you had an audience of everyone in the entire world who had ever had a life-altering accident for a few minutes, what would you make sure that they understood?
I would say that the response to whatever it was is really how you're defined. And I would also share that they have a responsibility to share their experience. I think we all have these wonderful stories and these wonderful stories of grit and tenacity and resilience. And in this wonderful world, you know, that we live in, that we work in, that I think we need to hear each other's stories. Part of my goal is to try to help a million people have their last bad day. And I think there's so many, like, as I've gone around and done talks, so many people come up to me and say, well, my last bad day was X. And, you know, they're not famous. They're not an influencer on Instagram or social media. They don't have this like big empire, right? They're just your neighbor, like someone at the grocery store, someone at the post office that has this incredible story of rebounding, of resilience. And for me, as I met more and more of these people, because I'm not like hugely famous either. And I think there's some wonderful stories just within our communities. And we tend to have this like dependency on celebrity for our inspiration and motivation. Mm-hmm. And I would say, like, listen, if you're just, and it's just like, if you have this wonderful story, share it with one person, share it with 10, share it with 15, but share it because someone needs to hear that story. It's the story they need to hear in that moment. And there was a time where I shared my story when I came back to work and then I stopped sharing it for a variety of different reasons. And that could be a completely different show. But what I realized is I was as I was leaving corporate America to do the work I do now, is that I have a responsibility to share the story because someone out there needs to hear it to help them get through a bad moment so it doesn't turn into a bad day. And I think for everyone else that have had moments like these, I think it's part of our responsibility to share it and help people realize that it's all possible, like within our little community. You don't have to necessarily go to celebrity for inspiration and motivation. It's cool that if you do, I still do. But I think there's some wonderful stories just among us that are even more powerful.
Wow. Well, thank you from the bottom of my heart for sharing your story and all that you do. I'm kind of just blown away. Like, I'm excited to re-listen to this with a pen and just poof. So your sweet daughters, you mentioned them at the beginning. If you could ensure that they knew one thing that their dad stands for, what would that one thing be?
I would say, that's a really good question. I would say abundance, that they can be anything. I'm going to get choked up. They can be anything that they desire, that they don't have to live in a world of scarcity, that they can do and create and change the world in a small way, in a big way, and never get caught up in those moments of doubt, because they can be incredible. And I think, it's one of the reasons why I do the work I do, is to try to, in a small way, a big way, try to help support that. So I would say abundance.
So good.
So we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, perfect. What are you working on right now that you're most excited about?
Well, over the last couple of weeks, the new book came out. And for me, I see this happening all the time in my travels, where a bad moment turns into a bad day. And I read some crazy stat, it was from a study last year, that on average, people have 60 bad days a year. I was like, holy cow. It was like a fitness app or something like that that did the study. And I'm like, that's like one bad day a week, or actually more than one a week. And then when you add up like a 40 years of a career or what have you, like from like say 25 to 65, that's like 6.5 years of bad days. And I was like, wow, that's like a powerful stat. And if some of people hear my story, maybe they don't have their last bad day, maybe they do. It would be great if they did. But if we could just reduce the number, like if we can reduce the number of bad days out there, we could do more great work together. And I think the world needs more great work. We have some pretty big problems to solve. We need like all of our mojo and energy to solve these problems. So we can't solve those problems if we're having a bad day. In some small way, people that hear my story and it helps them shift their perspective and bring more intentionality and gratitude and resilience into their lives, then that's pretty cool. And so that's what I'm really, really jazzed about as we sort of finish off on 2019.
Best place to find your book, would that be Amazon?
Yeah, so they can find it on Amazon. You can also go to my website and buy a copy. The copy is free there. They just have to pay shipping and handling, but they get a benefit. They get the first chapter of my memoir. So that's pretty cool. So that's a really cool way of going about doing it. And I can actually give you a code, Monica, that you can put in the show notes where they can get 25% off shipping and handling. So that's actually a better deal than what Jeff Bezos can offer them. So.
Well, that's perfect. Definitely. We'll definitely get that in the show notes. Awesome. So where can my listeners go to find you and get more of that great energy and content that you're providing?
So best bet is to just go to my website, michaelobryanshift.com. There you can find all the social media places that people hang out at, but you can learn more about me there. So that's best bet.
Awesome. We'll definitely link to that, and I'll make sure I spell your name correctly because I have misspelled it a few times. But thank you so much for your time today. This has been absolutely incredible. I have loved our conversation and all of the just wisdom that you have just blanketed us with. So thank you so much for your time and for your life's work. So grateful.
Well, thanks for having me, Monica. I love your show. As you know, I listen to your show. And so I might not be like your ideal customer or listener or whatever, avatar, but I love the authenticity and genuineness and realness that you bring to the world through your podcast and the other things that you do. So it was my honor to be with you today.
Well, I sure appreciate that. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
I absolutely loved that interview and love how honest and real Michael was with his story about how difficult that accident was for him and how difficult the whole forgiveness process was for him. Because whether it's an accident or something else, we all will experience hard times and we will all experience pain that isn't necessarily our fault. And I feel like I have been taught in the last few weeks so strongly how much it is our choice how to deal with that type of pain. It is our decision to forgive, and it is our choice to figure out how that story will be told and how we will continue to move forward, whether it's carrying that backpack full of rocks or whether we will choose to forgive and put that backpack down and live our very best possible life. And so I feel like there were so many fantastic lessons in that interview. I just have to listen several more times with a pen and take notes and really have so much respect for Michael O'Brien and for the message he's putting out in the world. And I love at the end how he talked about how important it is for each and every one of us to tell our stories, whether we feel like we're qualified or not. There's someone out there who needs what only we can provide. And so important, as I've been talking about through the last year and a half on this podcast, how important it is for us to find our purpose, for us to take the experiences of our lives and the gifts that we have received from all the different trials and growing experiences that we have ourselves lived through, and to be able to put that into gifts for others, to be able to make the world a better place and influence and impact the lives of others. I feel so strongly about that. And I love those aha moments when I feel like the heavens open up and God is allowing me to share my experiences and my gifts with other people. So I had a lot of emotions recording that podcast episode, and I'm so excited that Michael will also be joining us for the Epic Marriage Summit, which is going to be October 8th through the 10th. So stay tuned for more details about that. The next several podcast interviews are going to be an opportunity for you to get to know those summit presenters, and their presentations are going to be completely different and unrelated to the podcast. But I love that you guys are going to get to know them better so that you have kind of the foundation and groundwork of who they are when they're speaking to you about their incredible marriage lessons that they have to share. So make sure you get that on your calendar, October 8th through the 10th, the Epic Marriage Summit. And I'll make sure that you guys have all the information leading up to that. So the next few interviews are going to be great. So look forward to those. Make sure you hit subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Leave me a review or comment in any way you can. You can do that through social media. You can do that through email. You always remember to have courage, be kind, and stay on the brighter side.